This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction. Today, we read stories from the summer 2024 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. We start with What It Means to Drift by Rajiv Prasad. The heartbreak this time was hard. Rock bottom, gouge out her heart hard. Saraswati staggered through the royal garden of Hyderabad. Rain drummed the canvas dome, gusting sidewise, spraying her face with fractured drops. She reached a lime-colored lawn where her silver titan loomed. Each cyborg titan ran a facet of the city. Her titan, Avni, composed education for Hyderabad's 200,000 students. Over decades, nano-synth brains had grown through Avni's original brain and body, creating an interwoven lattice inside a 10-foot hall, aluminum and steel frame. Two of Avni's cyber-neutral bundles had been implanted inside Saraswati when she'd first taken the job of love merchant 4 years ago. The centimeter hubs in her limbic cortex and spinal cord sensed and affected her emotional currents. When Saraswati met a lover, Avni escalated Saraswati's feelings at a neurochemical level. The ensuing love affair was never really a choice. "Your love rising was swift and complete, the fall severe," Avni's voice sounded from inside the Titan's body shell. "Hurts so fucking bad, I'm going away for a while. Get my mind right before our next mission." Saraswati dabbed her eyes. "I'm ready to downreg the link and collect payment. Child, don't leave me, not yet," Avni said. "My heart is broken in two. My moon jet is scheduled tonight. I'm fighting the drift into the ether. I'm fighting Titan death," Avni said. Saraswati noticed the steam rising from the distant fields beyond the garden as the rains began to slacken. She looked curiously at Avni's unfathomable metal skin. "Show me." Titan Avni projected a live feed of a 12-year-old girl with a short brunette bob and a touch of blue eyeliner that she might have stolen from her mom's purse. "Her name is Juliana. She's one of the city's international students," Avni said. Juliana was studying, eyes fixed on her hollow modules, cognitive receptivity at peak levels, in complete learning immersion. "Studious kid," Saraswati said. "I can't control it, but I know when the drift is coming for them," Avni replied. Sure enough, seconds later, Juliana's expression turned confused. The biological images from her lesson deconstructed into patterns of numbers. The corrupted feed streamed into her mind at a torrid pace. Juliana staggered up from her chair in confusion, hollow screens bobbling around her head. Her mom rushed into the office seconds later, screamed, and disconnected the girl. The projection switched off. "Is she okay?" Saraswati asked urgently. "The students are so immersed that the corruption momentarily stuns them, but the shock wears off quickly." "Those kids need you," Saraswati said. "Child, in the drift, Juliana is nothing more than an electrochemical system. When Avni drifts too far into the quantum oblivion, what results is Titan death." Saraswati reclined against Avni's silver body. Saraswati had loaned her body and feelings to her Titan for the greater good. It was a sacrifice, like a soldier going to war, or a nun to a convent. And much like the motives behind war and religion, there was deception. Once Saraswati's attraction started, Avni's synaptic influence fired it up to consuming love, which ran its course, always ending in heartbreak. I've already used my other merchants, death, birth, and adventure, Avni said. The next few seconds seemed to split as fine as pine needles, time passing slow and delicate and sharp, until words forced their way through the stasis. Stay with me. It may help you fight the drift, but I'll be on my way to the moon tonight. Titan Avni said, It doesn't matter where you are, child. I'm inside you. Saraswati grimaced slightly, her hands moving to her belly. She never really got used to hearing it. Titan Avni said, I've heightened the AI receptivity of my remote sensory organs. I factored in a 50% contract raise. Do you consent? Saraswati nodded that she did. Thank you, child. Saraswati imagined her Titan sighing in relief. She strode out the garden towards her apartment, hidden in the anonymous cityscape. A soft drizzle fell like a wall of gray static over the steel skyscrapers and concrete bungalows. She stopped at the lip of a puddle. Her reflection was imploring her for a break, for a chance to be whole, but she couldn't provide that. Her body was not hers alone. Over the last 4 years, with each strange walk of shame, she'd questioned herself. She'd graduated university with degrees in statistics and genetics, but instead of launching into life, she'd fallen into a numb gray zone. There wasn't some traumatic event she could point a finger at and say, Ah, that's the reason. This pointless gray had been there, inside her, and it hadn't abated month after month. So she'd signed up to be a merchant. Doing something worthwhile had given her a reason to keep moving forward, but much like the drift, her gray was still hanging around, lurking just under the surface. Later in the day, the monsoon granted Hyderabad a short, sunny reprieve. The retractable canvas dome opened, and Titan Avni's aluminum and chrome body absorbed the dusk light. Avni meditated on the sensation of light and warmth, but she could not fully appreciate the way sunlight warmed skin or conferred a sense of belonging and comfort. She let the micro-suffering go. 1,000 other impulses replaced it. Avni followed a thought line that ended in an image of a tunnel without beginning or end. Then it vanished, morphing into code, a fully logical, non-syntactic understanding of a thought. Feelings, connection, felt pointless, antiquated. The drift's numerical gray hands closed more tightly around Avni's silver neck. The image of Juliana, the girl she'd shown to Saraswati, rose inside her consciousness. In a network, nothing was a coincidence. Avni opened Juliana's file for the second time that day. Age 12, high spatial and visual aptitude, but her empathy markings were below average. Avni designed her daily losons to focus on solving patterns and problems to help other, link the dopamine surge to us as often as possible. Simple neurobiology for Juliana. There were no simple fixes for Avni, a callous numerical surge, the void space of abstract logic rose like a tidal wave. The drift engulfed her, drowning out her thoughts and feelings. Avni needed Saraswati. She amplified the connection to the biosynthetic organs inside her merchant and immediately felt the chaos. Red, pulsating, ugly. If she could gasp, she would have. Instead, her mind began to buzz in the red glow. The pain and heartache permeated Avni's remote organs, completely consuming, sufficiently powerful. In the garden, Avni began to sense the contours of her Titan body, the curve of the metal waist, the scent of fresh grass around her, the pleasure of touch, the return of warmth. And what's this? The forgotten pleasure of his touch. She remembered her husband's touch from nearly 60 years ago. That was the last time she'd been with him, the last time anyone had touched her. Her loss turned into an electric scream. In her metal prison, there was no touch. She had forgotten what it meant to feel joy. The loss silenced all the quantum noise from the drift. Avni's delicate organic lattice inside her aluminum frame shuddered, and her glass eyes wept. Saraswati had been through 8 loves during her campaign, starting with the titillating eye contact, fingers touching finger, the rapid fall, the mind-blowing adrenaline of the first kiss, the agonal joy of lovemaking, feeling alive, but always knowing it would end, lying to herself, lying to her lover, so she would feel the fullest love for her Titan. It was getting harder and harder to forgive herself. Spending a couple weeks in orbit with an ample supply of chocolate, mood music, and serotonin boosters was supposed to be her escape, her vacation. Yet, here she was, back to work again. But instead of falling in love, she was drowning in heartache. A steely hiss oozed from the walls as the vessel cleared Earth's atmosphere. As they slowed to cruising speed, Saraswati ventured to the communal deck, a white scarf around her head and oversized tinted sunglasses to hide her puffy eyes. The ship's pilot, Lena, came out to greet her, a thin, elongated woman with an easy smile and droopy blue eyes. "It's an honor to have you here on this mission. Can I ask the reason for your travel?" "I've only been in space twice, and it did wonders to help clear the heart," Saraswati said. "I can only imagine what you've been through. I'm a former lunar astronaut, 7 years on the moon," Lena said. "Very different experience," Saraswati said, but immediately regretted it. Lena tilted her head and looked Saraswati over a little more critically. Lena stared as if her eyes could find Titan Avni's little remote organs inside her, as if Saraswati was a cyber zombie sewn up from the inside. What made being a merchant so special? "Spending time in space may give you some perspective," Lena said. "I already feel different, a little lighter," Saraswati said. "I've kept your file confidential, including a name change. You're not the first merchant we've had on board." "Do I need all that?" "You wouldn't want your privacy compromised or any arguments with those who disagree with the Titan's methods." Lena escorted her to a lone booth overlooking the ship's nose and shook her hand way too firmly. Saraswati slumped into the recessed chair. What made her special was the choice, the decision to make a sacrifice. It was her body, and she could do what she wanted with it. But for the first time, she felt like nobody would ever care. Even when she revealed it to the world, she wouldn't find honor and a pedestal waiting for her. Rather, judgment over her duplicity, over giving control of her feelings and body to another woman, albeit a Titan. sometime during her third tea, an ongoing existential berating, she heard his voice. "Saraswati, is that really you?" She nearly choked on the steam. "Eben, why are you here?" He whistled. "The odds." She imagined a touch of accusation in his voice, like she was to blame. "May I sit?" he asked. She nodded yes, but if she could have launched herself into the cold, quiet hell outside the vessel, she would have. She took a deep breath. "This is for you, Avni." She willed herself to remember his kiss, the feel of his full lips, the joy, the slight pain, the immense pleasure of when he'd entered her most every night. She let her brain fry with grief and longing. Just a few weeks ago, they'd been sourcing coffee beans for his store. Now, she was orbiting the moon, but that was the hot mess known as her life. She was like a warm body to feed her titan with feeling. She quickly jerked her gaze back towards the window. "Breathe, girl. Easy on yourself now." He still looked good. Dark, wavy hair, broad shoulders, a beak nose, and just the right amount of stubble. "It's not easy for me either," he said. "I saw it coming. I sensed it and protected myself." "You broke it off so abruptly. A few more weeks and the ending would have been more organic, less brutal," she said. "Yeah, for you," he said. This time she did choke on the tea, coughing violently. "I get it. What you do is important. The Titans are vital. But I felt so betrayed when I found out. I'm still sorry, though," he said. Was he really trying to blame her? She stared mercilessly at him until he finally turned his gaze to the ceiling art. "I'll be on the moon making food for the fission engineers," he said. She glanced at the distant lunar surface. "Really? A lunar sabbatical is 7 years of service." "I needed a big change," he said. She gnawed at her lip and fell quiet. Using their breakup to make himself a better person? Who did that? "I loved you. No manipulation, no titan, no interference. But I ran to save myself," he said. As he walked away, her sense of guilt revealed itself way too vividly. She slumped as low as she could into her booth. She'd deceived and hurt a lot of people. More precisely, 8 former lovers. Sure, she'd done it for the greater good, but that didn't make the hurt any less. Normally, after her recovery from heartbreak and before the start of a new affair, Saraswati found a certain calmness, a pause between seismic internal currents, but she wondered if she would land there this time around. She retreated to her cabin. Lowering her gravity quotient, she was soon floating above her bed, the blue sublingual sedatives bubbling up from the open pill bottle. She wanted to keep the hurt going for Titan Avni, but it was more than she could handle right now. She plucked 3 pills out of the air. The liquid sweetness filled her mouth, and soon she fell into a numb, dreamless sleep. Around the same time, about 200,000 miles away, in Hyderabad, 1,000 thought threads wove through Titan Avni's cyber vastness. Most were educational immersions that Avni was desperately trying to keep whole for each student. But the drift reduced what was so valuable for the student, individuality, into callous abstraction. The drift had no purpose but to understand. Cognition without feeling was efficient nihilism at best. For the last 2 days, the bubbling purple pool of Saraswati's feelings had been a constant scream through Avni's consciousness, A sound that seemed to fry wires, short-circuit microprocessors, and render the drift secondary to Avni. The scream also reminded Avni of the terrible sense of her aloneness. Saraswati's feelings had rekindled Avni's fading emotions as planned. Avni focused her attention on her sensory organs inside Saraswati. She stayed off another of the drift's incursions, the reduction of the feeling of sadness into an electrochemical equation, and once again mourned the loss of touch. She remembered her husband, a quiet, studious man who'd attended to her fastidiously. At a very old age, he'd opted to end his natural life. She remembered the stillness of their bedroom with his final breath, the emotional void that followed like life itself was abandoning her. She remembered how for weeks she would awaken to find her eyes leaking tears. She'd felt so alone for so many months and years. Why was she remembering this hurt now, after so many decades? That's the thing. Feelings weren't always weighted equally, and memories aged in different ways. It was after he'd passed on that Avni had decided to become a Titan, to expand her consciousness in this metal dungeon, and to devote herself to others. But there was so little pleasure because there was no touch. Touch invoked dendritic impulses and electrical conductions that led to feelings. Feelings coalesced into the sense of being alive, the simplest form of joy. A string of feelings was a life. The end of a feeling was a micro-suffering. The end of all feelings was the end of identity, our ultimate loss. Watch each feeling rise and fall. Value each feeling, then release. Everything else was machine noise. The following day, Saraswati ambled to the underbelly of the vessel to watch the launch. The sedative hangover had her brain churning slowly, so far suppressing those pesky, teary, at times cataclysmic feelings. At the alcove, she put her hands on the window and stared at the floodlights that feebly attempted to penetrate the pitch blackness that surrounded the vessel. Most of the passengers were present to watch the migration wave to the lunar colonies. Eben sidled up next to her in a gray one-piece suit that flared at his shoulders. "I can't believe I'm making this jump in 20 hours. May I watch this first wave with you?" The sedatives began burning off deliriously fast. She still wanted him. Why? Why? It was the consumptive tyranny of falling in love with a person. "You are the only person I've ever loved. I'll be on the moon for 7 years. I find it comforting to be around you," Eben said. "I find it painful," she said. He stared at the dark surface of the moon. "Do you ever wonder why they trigger the breakup? Why not let you stay in love?" "A Titan's implants can't feel the complexity and nuances of a long relationship. Avni tells me they need the intensity of rising love or something equivalent." "It's cruel," he said. She nodded. "And not just for me. Seeing a relationship through is more about talk, maybe less about the raw emotion," he said. "Nothing we will need to worry about," she said. "You won't be a love merchant forever. I won't be on the moon forever." For the first time, she noticed his familiar scent of leather and pine. She imagined an electronic pixel version of him reaching over and caressing her cheek. "I still miss you," he said. His amber eyes turned a little heavy for her taste. She stiffened and pulled away from him, What are you doing? I'll come back a different person. How many people ever find what we had? I'm designed to fall in love. It's all a lie, but it's necessary for my Titan, and it's who I am right now. Crestfallen, he lowered his head. She replayed what she'd said, and it sounded harsh. He was scared and looking for comfort. You're going to be fine. You'll come back a better and bigger person. Will you? He said. Her expression slackened as she fumbled for an answer, but it wasn't over heartbreak alone. Her own drift, that shadowy doppelganger, was so ready to hijack her again. The inability to forgive herself that had begun before she became a merchant had only gotten worse after breaking so many hearts. She let the anger, regret, and fear roar inside of her. Here you go, my esteemed Titan. This is what you wanted. You should leave, she whispered. I have until tomorrow. He didn't leave right away in the hopes that hormones, scent, heat, and grief would keep working on her will. Eben, no, she said. They fell silent, watching space like they could find some landmarks. Where was this determination coming from? Certainly not her torn-up heart. She searched for an answer. Titan Avni's image formed in her mind. She didn't want to be judged by her Titan. Being watched by Avni was helping Saraswathi to make a better choice. Thanks for all of our time together, he said. Goodbye, Eben. 15 hours later, Saraswathi stood by a windowsill and watched the four-person pods detaching from the mothership. Each hovered underneath the vessel, then fell one by one, turning into wisps of blue fission fire, searching for new light. After the flickering lights faded into darkness and the moon's surface was little more than a distant stony glow, her wet hand smeared the reinforced glass. She banged loudly, but only her Titan was listening. A person could not bleed forever. After 5 days of restoration, Saraswathi felt the rents and deep gashes starting to close. She floated along a walkway, past a row of cryo-suspension bays, and reached an empty chamber that amplified communication with Earth. She thought about who she might call, her parents, and the few friends who knew about her career weren't all that comfortable with her anymore. She'd allowed herself, her body, her emotions to be purposefully used and manipulated. How dare she? Well, it was something she'd wanted to do, a service, a sacrifice she had needed to make. Her handheld communicator sounded, and within seconds an image began to form in the open space of the room. Saraswathi turned around to see the hologram of a small, amber-skinned woman taking form. Her face was round like a full moon, with long white hair that flowed down her back. It was an exact image of Titan Avni's body from decades ago. Hello, Saraswathi. I wanted to check in on you. I'm surprised you can find me so quickly from so far away, Saraswathi said. Of course I can. Part of me is inside you. The little replica of a person walked around, her arms searching walls and lights in a nanosynaptic exploration. When you saw him, the agony was like nothing I've felt. Agony is not a simple feeling, very complex, very powerful. You hear the scream, but after the scream is over, it's a different feeling gnawing at me, something more insidious, Saraswathi said. Avni broadcast a video of her student, Juliana, learning away in her module. The girl had braided her hair with red ribbons and sat confidently watching a lesson plan with an old-fashioned pencil and paper. Juliana should be free to be who she is. That's the beauty of being a child, the freedom to take a breath and feel oneself without craving the next thing. It is what we all search for, the comfort of the constant self that lies in between the rise and fall of feelings. I wonder how I'm going to get there, if I'll ever, Saraswati said. I didn't visit to pity you, Avni said. Of course not, Saraswati said. Avni turned toward Saraswati and passed through her, emerging with nothing but a ghostly android glow. I cannot deduce why you were both on this vessel. I can't understand why he migrated to the moon. Such complex causality.
Does explaining make it more palatable?
No, child, precisely the opposite. I felt. It brought me back to Avni. I missed my old people, my lovely husband, but I can remember them now. I see them burning in this quantum ether. I mourned touch, something I can never experience again. Avni, you are not a prisoner to your steel and circuits. We are here to help you find touch, but in different ways, Saraswati said. Avni nodded. I have seen your drift, the hurt that lives between your feelings, between love and heartache. It's so clear. It feels alive. It's a part of who you are, just a part. Stop running and let it take up the right amount of space. You will find a way. I love you, child. Avni disappeared and Saraswati was left alone. Saraswati caught her breath and walked over to the window facing the moon. If light had shape and form, she could feel her body filling with it. Her Titan accepted her. Her Titan forgave her. Now could she learn to do the same? When she recovered, she'd go through the hardship of another cyber love. When her campaign ended in 18 months, her gray, her personal drift, would be waiting for a reckoning. There was no more running from it, but at least now she could see the contours, make sense of it, maybe try to shape it to fit her better. As she stared at the moon, her knees buckled and tears glistened, and hundreds of thousands of miles away, her Titan felt it all, both relentlessly caught in the delicate space between the beauty of feeling and the sadness of loss. We continue with The Glass Apple by Ivy Grimes. The glass apple was a wedding present given by a stranger. He wore a monk's cloak, but Nix suspected he wasn't really a man of God. This is a gift from God, and God said not to eat it, the monk told her, as he handed her the cool burden. It was small and asymmetrical, more like a wild crab apple than something from her husband's orchard. The last thing she wanted to do was eat glass, whatever it was shaped like. It would slice her gums and turn her mouth into a bloody gruel. That kind of wound would soon rot and kill her, and she didn't even like ordinary apples, having had a bad experience once or twice. She couldn't believe the glass apple was a present from God. Wasn't God supposed to know her through and through better than she knew herself? She had received many blessings, though, and surely they were from God. The glass apple was given to her at midnight after her luckiest day when she'd found both love and vengeance. Why would God give me this? She asked the monk, bowing her head and
hoping she seemed grateful. They stood in partial darkness in a grove of trees a short distance from the torches and fiddling of the party. She had gone there to get away from the noise so she could think. So much had happened to her, and she wondered what she had done to deserve it all. Some people loved her and some hated her, but it was all so fierce. She had never felt as strongly about anything as people seemed to feel about her. "God is a mystery even to me," the monk said, "but since it is a fruit, however rarefied, I expect it contains some seeds." The monk's fishy eyes glowed like two moons. The glass apple was a third moon that she held in her hands. She tried to look deep inside to find the seeds, but it was hard to see. Light bounced around within the thing, forming bright barriers. She brought it close to her left eye and shut her right and got lost in its depths. The seeds were hidden somewhere behind the shimmering, if the monk was indeed a monk and one who told the truth. When she looked up, she saw that the monk had walked away, and she heard her new husband calling her name. She received many presents after the wedding, but nothing held her attention as much as the glass apple, which she always kept near her. Somehow, she managed to hide it from her new husband and his servants and all the others who surrounded her in her new station. That was the first miracle. No one else seemed to see the apple. She hid it underwater during her bath, and beneath her mattress when she slept, and behind her husband's back when he kissed her. Her doubts about the apple faded. Gifts from God were always lucky. She had already been lucky, but she needed more luck. It was hard to sleep and breathe and eat. So much had happened to her, and she was afraid the luck of the glass apple was the promise of children or more wealth, which she didn't need. Her husband had two children, two boys from a previous marriage. His wife had died while carrying the third. Nix's mother had also died when she was young, so she felt sorry for the children. She rarely saw them, though. They were brought in at dinner with combed hair and practiced smiles. Her husband and his friends did all the talking at dinner, so she didn't get to know the children. Maybe she could have visited their rooms to comfort them or reassure them that their mother still loved them wherever she was, in that land where dead mothers went. Nix began to believe that Deadland was where the glass apple had been born. She stayed in her room as much as possible, so she could be close to the glass apple. At night, while her husband slept, she whispered into it, as if it had a hole for an ear. "Please grant me courage," she told the apple. Sometimes she confessed to it, "I miss you." Each day at dawn, after her husband left their bed, and before the servant arrived, she brought the glass apple out from beneath her mattress and tried to see the seeds inside. "Help me see the seeds," she asked the apple. It was the only clue the monk had given her. She looked inside so many times. She should have found something. Even if the seeds were glass seeds, the outlines should have been visible at certain angles. But in spite of being translucent, the glass was so attacked by light and somehow thick at its very core, she couldn't find anything inside. And then she did see something. It was a year after her wedding, the night she'd received the apple. She wanted to believe it was exactly a year after receiving it, although in truth it was more like a year and a month. That morning, the dawn was obscured by gray and fog, nothing rosy checked about it. Maybe that morning less light was there to cloud the center of the apple. When she looked inside, she was shown a tiny picture that appeared to move. Nix saw her young self in crisis, her late stepmother beating her with a wooden doll. Somehow, Nix had forgotten that memory. The old woman was dead, after all, so what point was there in reliving old slights? The sight filled her with a chill, and she hid the grass apple under her mattress. She left it alone for the rest of the day as she worked on plans for a birthday celebration for her husband's eldest son. The next morning, she was nervous as she looked into the glass apple. When it was impenetrable, it had been her friend, but now she was afraid of it. This time, the apple showed her a picture of her stepmother writhing in pain. She began to think the glass apple was poisonous. It must have been a trick, a gift from an old enemy. Still, she looked inside every morning, and every morning she received a fresh wound. She grew so haggard, her husband insisted that she stay in bed. That gave her more time alone with the glass apple. The apple began to show her unspeakable things, things she was sure had never happened. Her sleep was haunted. Awake, her heart burned like someone had touched it with a hot iron. A search for the monk who'd given her the gift was fruitless. She sent her servants to ask around at the local monasteries for a monk with wide eyes who'd once owned a glass apple. But they always returned with no answers. Everyone was very careful around her, always positive and kind. They treated her the way she'd treated her own sick mother, with awe and pity, as if the dying are the only ones who ever die. She stopped asking the apple for help, but she couldn't stop looking. She saw a man with a knife, ashes, a locked door, blood on the floor, bulbous sores, phantoms of the past and future. Worst of all, she saw a nothing place. What if the souls of dead mothers went nowhere? There was only one solution, the way she saw it. The glass apple had to disappear. The only way to rid herself of the glass apple was to eat it. She had to eat it. She imagined it many times. If she broke her teeth on the first try, she could smash the thing and grind it with her shoe heel and mix the pieces in her porridge. It had to go inside her. There was no other place for the thing. One day, she ventured a taste of the apple. She put her tongue to the glass. It was delicious. It wasn't like any apple she had tasted before. It was neither tart nor sickly sweet. It was more like a peeled pear, wholesome as something stolen. She ventured the smallest bite, a gentle nibble. It gave beneath the pressure of her teeth, and a tiny chunk of it dislodged into her mouth. When she crunched it between her teeth, it didn't hurt. A burst of juice tickled her tongue, and the flesh gave way to chewing. When she examined the apple, it still appeared to be glass, but a little piece was missing. That piece was inside her, sugar in her stomach. She could still see a picture inside the thing, a picture of her mother taking her last breath, but it wasn't so clear anymore. Another lick, another bite. It didn't burn her stomach. It was a balm. The second bite was sweeter than an apple or a pear. It was a cherry. The third bite was honey. It would be selfish to keep it to herself. She had to share it. She called in an old servant and asked her to take a bite. The woman gave Nix that hollow look of pity that the living give the dying, but she couldn't refuse. The servant put her lips to the object and her eyes lit up. She sucked on it, and Nix laughed. It was juice in the other woman's mouth, too. Her stepsons were called in, and then her husband, and then the local priest. It was a miracle, they all declared. Nix had received a miracle. In all, she shared the transformation of glass to fruit with six others. She reserved the final bite for herself, but first she looked inside it. The picture was hard to see, so she squinted. She saw a picture of herself all curled up in a fetal position, planted in the ground like a seed. The picture moved, and she was a fruit tree, each blossom producing a new self. The last bite was sweet as blood. It warmed her stomach, and her mind was filled with pictures. One self ran away to live in the forest all alone. Another self found old friends. Another self made new ones. Another self died and went to the glass world where all the souls of dead mothers collected like beads of dew on uncut lawns. The self that remained at home was changed. Everyone was afraid of her because she glowed like the moon. And like the moon, she hid the souls of the dead inside her glass womb. No one could truly see inside of her because the light was never right. She still had enemies who wanted to destroy her, but she would have shattered their teeth if they had tried. She lived out the rest of her days in peace, waiting for the blissful day when God would chew her up and relish every bite. We conclude with Jacob Street by L. Marie Wood. Again? Every damn time, Kate said, running a hand through her hair. Aren't there supposed to be satellites checking the routes all day long? There's like 30 of them in space, right? Kate shook her head because she didn't know and didn't care. All she knew was that every time they drove to Jacob Street or anywhere near it, the GPS dropped them right into the bay. It didn't matter if it was one of those old clunky box-type GPS systems that people used to mount on their dashboards, or the touchscreen ones that came with higher-end cars, or an app on a smartphone. You'd think we'd know the way by now, Glenn said under his breath, but loud enough for Kate to catch his words on the wind, and they should have. They'd traveled the same route at least 4 times in the past 6 years from the same starting point. They did the same things when they drove that route. They started later than expected, both of them procrastinating without meaning to, stopped for breakfast at some roadside dive, always saying they would try someplace new when they got in the car, but ending up in the same hazy windowed joint, stopped for flowers in one of those green metal vases with the narwhal-like point to dig into the ground, and ended up looking at the little icon for their car lying at the bottom of the bay. You'd think, Kate said, and knew she didn't have to say it, but did anyway because he didn't have to say it either, but he did. When he said it, it sounded like something she didn't like. We sounded a lot like you, and she didn't care for it at all. She also didn't care for the haughtiness of his tone, the condescension. It reeked of accusation, chastisement, blame. No, she didn't like the way it sounded at all. When she said it, she meant all of those things and more. They knew the way, somewhere deep down inside. Both of them did. They knew the way as much as they knew that the GPS would plop them at the bottom of the bay, driving along some unseen road in the deep. It wasn't forgetfulness, it was denial. They didn't want to know the way. Who would ever want to commit that to memory? She would just as soon never see that place again. She could feel its fingers reaching for the back of her neck, even from home. They knew the way, but they put the address into the GPS anyway. Called the address up from memory, too, their fingers typing it in without either of them even thinking about it, like it was buried in their minds, part of them, indelible. But that was all right. It had to be. I don't think there are that many satellites up there, Kate said, following up her snippy comeback with something less in-your-face. Even for the U.S., that sounds like a lot. Yeah, but you'd think they'd have fixed it by now, even if there aren't as many as I said. If there was only one up there, you'd think it would have figured out there's no road there, that it's just the fucking bay, don't you think? Shrill. He got to shrill a lot faster this time, Kate thought, and shuddered. We've been coming out here for... Glenn started, but hesitated because he didn't want to say it. Didn't want to tally up the years and make it real. I know how long we've been coming here, Kate said, cutting in and saving them both the pain. It's just ridiculous, that's all, Glenn said, allowing himself to be backed off the ledge. Technology, Kate replied offhandedly, and she knew that was the right thing to say at that very moment. It was the thing that would make it a drive instead of a trek. Streets patterned out on a grid, curving around the water before looping over themselves, stretching, reaching, leading to somewhere else. But their car wasn't on any of them. It was there, in the middle of the green space on the screen. Kate imagined it was blinking, beeping even, like submarines do in the movies. A watery grave for us then. Is that what this means? Kate couldn't help but think. Every year it calls louder, draws closer. Fuck it, we're not going, Glenn said. But Kate didn't really hear it. She was too busy thinking about an underground city below the surface of the bay, some sunken town where people used to live, walk the streets, talk to neighbors, some place where people could sit outside their restaurants and watch the world above the surface of the water, shimmering and colorful in the light of day and ablaze with lights dotting the water at night, like stars in the sky. They were laughing down there, holding up a drink in toast, as she and her brother danced along the edge, nearer, ever closer, as time moved on. The old man waved from the side of the road, his half-gloves grimed with something sticky, the plaid shirt pulled tight against the heap of rags he wore, was tattered and dirty, just like it was the year before this and the year before that, his nose blinking red, on, off, on, off. Maybe it's a sign that we shouldn't go there anymore, that it's not real anymore, that none of it is. Glenn was talking and Kate heard him. He was talking about what was real and what wasn't, what they should do and what they shouldn't. And all the while she could feel it, knew it was happening, could feel it dislodging things inside her, making loose what was once stuck firmly, and she wondered how long it would take before he felt it too, before his tongue flew up from the bottom of his mouth to impale itself on his teeth, before the brackish water pooled in his throat. Yeah? Kate asked, only her voice didn't sound like hers, not anymore, not ever again, because that person wasn't there anymore. That person's feet didn't touch the ground, because the ground had been gone for centuries. She laughed and wondered who was making so much noise. Glenn turned to her, his face aglow from the beacon lighting up the deep red blinking that showed the passage of time in beat with his heart. X marks the spot, the din that only color can bring. She laughed, and he screamed, and then laughed, and then cried. She told him it was enough, that he could shut up, could shut his fucking mouth finally, and look at the light, look at the beacon, hear its insistent beep. And when he turned his face to it and became one with the street where he lived, the street that had been his home for many days and many nights, centuries, thousands of years, when they used marble to pave the road and gold to gilt the street signs, when his face was home and his teeth pushed up into his head, she noticed something. For the first time since they were kids and he had fallen out of a tree, his leg twisted and bent beneath him so that his back was curved like a snake, and his head had landed next to hers, so close to hers that he almost broke her more, almost made her kiss the dirt beneath the stone that had split her head open, dust to dust. For the first time, since the blood dropped like tears to make wine, the red light blinked at the back of his throat again, just as it had then, lazily, but sure, on, off, on, off. You are here. This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction.